going to police force about leases, paper 3E. Who's going to?
Education session.
Okay. Gary?
Good morning, everyone. So, yeah, we're on paper 3E. Thank you, everyone.
We have 3E?
3E, yeah, E for echo. So this is the lessor accounting measurement of the underlying asset when the lease terminates prematurely.
And maybe, yeah, just before you start, Guy, just to obviously clarify, this is the education session, where obviously the idea is that, yes, we will be educating you, or you will be educating us in preparation for the joint meeting that we'll have this afternoon.
When's the joint meeting?
This afternoon.
Okay, educate us.
Okay.
So,
I'm always open. My whole life is one process of education. So.
What did you do?
Are we educable?
That's what I asked. Are you with me?
So, just in terms of the reason why we're bringing this paper back, I think we try and lay that out in the introduction. But just as a reminder, at the May 2012 board meeting, when discussing the impairment project, the boards made a tentative decision that for lessor accounting, when the receivable and residual model is applied, the lessor would use the proposed financial instrument impairment guidance when testing the receivable for impairments. And at that time, the staff acknowledged that the leases team, namely us, would come back to the board to consider the interaction of the lease receivable with the impairment testing, combined with how a lessor would actually recognize the underlying asset if the lease terminated and the lessor reclaimed the assets before the end of the proposed lease term. So that's why we're back with this paper now. We've laid out three options in the paper. Before I briefly discuss what those options are, just something that's probably worth mentioning in terms of understanding the paper. Our thinking was, if the lessor is applying the proposed impairment guidance to the lease receivable, then in terms of the ordering of how the process would work, immediately before the lessor reclaims the underlying asset, we would say that in addition to testing that receivable for impairments during the lease term, in theory they would perform an impairment test immediately before they reclaim the underlying asset. So just in terms of the ordering of the timing of how we think the accounting work, that's probably important to note, and that comes back in before all of our options. So in terms of the options then, we've got three options. We've labeled them X, Y, and Z. Someone in the FASB education session asked if that meant that's because we are done providing you with options and these are the last three options we'll hopefully bring to you. So I'm hoping that is the case. But we'll see where we get to. So in terms of those options, option X is the fair value option. So the idea there is that when the lessor re-recognizes the underlying asset, they recorded at fair value, and any difference between the lease receivable after any impairments plus the net residual assets, so the difference between those two amounts would be recorded as the gain or loss when re-recognizing the underlying asset. Option Y, which we've called the carrying amount of the lease-related assets, basically this says that after doing any impairment on that lease receivable, you would take the carrying value of the lease receivable plus the net residual asset value at that point in time. You would compare that, you wouldn't compare it to anything. You would just take those two numbers, add them together, and they become the carrying value of the underlying asset when the lessor reclaims the underlying asset. And option Z, which we've called the revised value, and what that effectively does is it says the lessor, when they reclaim the asset, they go back retrospectively and they pretend that they had all the information they needed, as if they had always known that asset was going to be reclaimed at the point of time that it was. And they recast their lease schedule saying, if I'd known that was the revised lease term, if I'd known that this was the payments that I was actually going to get, what would my deferred profit have been? What would my interest implicit in the lease have been? And basically redo the entire calculation. And basically then, when the lessor reclaims the asset, they would compare the carrying value of the lease receivable and the net residual at that point in time to whatever net residual amount they recalculated based on their revised lease schedule. And the difference between the two would be the gain or loss on repossession. So that's just a brief discussion of the three options. I'm not going to go through at this stage the advantages, disadvantages. I think that's pretty much all laid out in the paper. think the staff are proposing option Y, and I think with that I'll open it up to the board for questions.
Philippe.
Yeah, I support that. I think it's consistent. But of course, this is subject to the possibility that an impairment is recognized. After you have reclassified the two assets together, then you have a value which may no longer be justified by the economics.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think, yeah, sorry, I probably should have mentioned that, Philippe. I think in the paper we've said, obviously, when the lessor under option Y, when they re-recognize the underlying asset at the carrying value, that's probably an indicator of impairment, so they would probably have to test it for impairment under 36. Yeah. So there's no...
The value in use of that asset may no longer be the one which...
Correct.
Was under lease contract. Without the lease, it has a default value.
Yes.
Amaru?
No, the same point, just to confirm. So then, apply impairment in tandem with the recognition of the asset will in somewhat be similar to apply option X, fair value?
It would be if you had an impairment. So if the value, if the fair value of your assets actually gone below the carrying value of the two amounts, then yes, you'd get probably to a number that's very similar to option X. But if the value of your underlying has gone up or it still can recover that number, then you would get a different answer to option X.
I would feel very uncomfortable with option X. The idea that an item was at cost, it goes into a lease, the lease is cancelled, goes back, and then it is suddenly fair value just because of this return trip. It's a lot of structuring opportunities. I mean, either the model is to have the assets at fair value, all assets at fair value, that's it. But if not, if the option is to keep assets at cost, then I think the cost model should continue to go and not have an exception going to fair value just because you have a return trip with a lessee for a couple of months or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean...
It depends how you view the transaction. I mean, the leasing transaction. I mean, in some ways, I'm quite attracted.
It's not a sale. It's not a sale and lease back. It's a lease right of use. It's still your asset. If it was a sale and lease back, I would say, okay, maybe fair value... subject to the impairment test would be okay, but just because you have granted the right of use on your asset for a period of time and then it is cancelled for some reason, why should it trigger a revaluation to fair value if your model is not fair value?
Yeah. Makes no sense.
Well, it makes a little bit of sense, but the thing that swayed me probably is the consistency argument, the argument that what we're deciding in Y is consistent with what we've decided before. But I wasn't all that happy with that decision either, so I hope I'm being consistent.
Legal?
I suppose staff the proposal, but I have one question related to the point, the decision I don't like. You know, on real estate, so we decide if, you know, the, I think the decision is 17 line, you know, we made last month,
more or less.
Yes, more or less, 17, simply. And if you have, as I mentioned last, I used the example, you have 100 years building, real estate lease 50 years, and so our decision is we not recognize receivables, but analyze. I don't agree with such kind of decision. But related to what you just said, you should do impairment first before, you know, early completion or the termination of the lease. And you said you should impair first. And based on what you suggest, it will also not relate to impairment of the receivables, only the underlines. Am I right?
Sorry, in your example with the property, did we end up applying receivable and residual models to that?
So you're not, but then
this wouldn't apply. Sorry, and I probably should have made that clear as well. This only applies when the lessors applied the receivable and residual model, because you're only doing the impairment testing on the receivable, because that becomes the financial assets. So if you ended up in a lease classification that you do not apply the receivable and residual, so for most property, then you would continue to test that underlying under IS-36.
Yeah, I will think about further whether that's a problem, you know. Actually, you know, the reason why I'm against the decision is that actually what asset you hold has two different kind of nature of assets. One is receivable, totally financial assets. Another one analyze. But our decision is, even though you have 50 years receivables, you will not recognize those receivables. I will think about the rate to impact, okay. But currently I will support the proposal.
Stephen?
So this impairment loss on the receivable, which we exchange emails about, can I, this, the example on page 12, and got this impairment loss 21, lease receivable credit 21 to get the receivable down to 32. And the basis for that is that we've got the fair value of the asset of 80 and we're apportioning that fair value between the residual and receivable. And you've got portion of that fair value that relates to the receivable assumed, and then one way of doing it is so-and-so. That seemed to me to be somewhat arbitrary. And it doesn't affect the answer in option X. Mm-hmm. All it does is affect the split of the overall net gain or loss between an impairment of the receivable and the derecognition gain or loss. But the overall net effect is the same. But it does affect the answer in Y. So is it arbitrary? Are we going to specify how you do that split of the 80 between the receivable and the residual? And the question that I had to you was, why are we doing this impairment of the receivable in the first place? Why not just transfer the carrying amount of the receivable and the residual to the fixed asset, then test the fixed asset for impairment if necessary? So what's this debit credit 21 doing in here, and why is it necessary?
So I think I think you had a couple of questions there, Steve. So let me see if I can answer all of them. You can tell me if I got it right at the end. But I think the 32, in terms of the way we got that, we were saying, if the 80 represents the fair value of the entire underlying, that is effectively the PV of all your future cash flows, which is how we got to that fair value. So we're saying if you wanted to try and apportion that between the different periods, one way of doing that would be to say, well, if the 80 represents the PV of all my cash flows, if I wanted to work out how much of that fair value related to the remaining lease term, in other words, in this example, the remaining 2 years, what is the PV of the cash flow for those 2 years? Because if you added up then the remaining cash flows on this thing, it would all come back to 80. So we're saying, you know, the collateral effectively is the PV of the cash flows you think you could have got for the remaining lease term. That's the piece of the asset that you derecognized effectively.
And I think Gary's explaining, and I'll maybe just to then maybe, because your question might be, well, why are we doing, you know, because I think your follow-on question was, well, why are we maybe doing it this way, and why are we insisting on doing kind of an impairment testing of the receivable? Because to your point, which is that any time you're talking about one asset, in a sense, there's always going to be a certain amount of, you know, arbitrariness, I suppose, you're saying to, you know, how we apportion or split that fair value. But I suppose the reason we're doing this is to try and be consistent with the impairment guidance, you know, for financial assets and for the receivable, because we didn't want to have to have our own specific impairment guidance and leases. We thought it was better if this was a lease receivable and was a financial asset, let's go there. So both of those aspects are trying to follow that. So first of all, to be consistent with, you know, the impairment guidance, when you do the impairment testing of the receivable, you're trying to work out what is the fair value of the collateral that relates to that receivable, which necessitates kind of splitting that overall fair value number to try and, you know, work out what piece of that overall value do I think is the collateral, the fair value of the collateral that relates to the receivable. The other reason that we then are, you know, are saying, well, you know, to your point, well, if you're going to bring it back, why not just forget about the impairment testing before and only do it after? Again, that would, we think, you know, force you to override the impairment guidance in a sense that would kind of say this is, you know, getting the asset back is a trigger to do impairment testing. And the other scenario is that if you didn't impair, you know, if we veered away from that, you could possibly end up with different carrying amounts when you bring the asset back, depending on whether there was a trigger of impairment somewhere, you know, somewhere during the lease before you take it back, versus if there wasn't. Because what I'm trying to say is that if there was a trigger to do impairment testing of the receivable at some point before the time you got the asset back, you would have been recognizing this 21 or something like the 21. So meaning that if there's a gap between doing that impairment test and taking the asset back, you would end up getting a different measurement in a sense than if there wasn't a particular trigger and you just took the asset back, you know, without there having been a trigger of impairment at some point before.
I mean, one of the other reasons for me, Steve, at least, is that, and I think this was, as Petrina said, your second question, why we can't just add the two together and test it for impairment at that point in time, is for me the biggest reason is that might mean that in some cases you don't get an impairment if you had a lot of fat or a lot of deferred profits sitting in your residual. Because if, for example, you did it the way you're proposing, if I'm understanding you right, you would say, I add the two assets together and then I test for impairment. But remember that underlying, the piece of the residual asset, we recorded it net of the, there's a deferred profit piece that was never recognized, which means the carrying amount of that piece is lower than its fair value. Now, if you only leased out 30% of your asset or 50% of your asset and that you're a manufacturing lessor and there's a big piece of profit sitting in that residual asset, that might, when you add it together with the lease receivable, mean that overall the number is still recoverable, but there was really an impairment on the piece that relates to the receivable. So you don't record that piece of the loss because you've got enough buffer in your residual, which I think we didn't think was the right answer. So to Petrina's point, you get a different answer if you did the impairment test before you reclaimed the asset. Does that make sense?
I'm
not convinced.
In this point, shouldn't we expect the impairment to show up before the repossession, especially in a forward-looking model that we are developing?
There should be an impairment allowance from day one, in theory, subject to the value of the underlying. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Like Steve, I wrote down, I didn't get the 32 that you have in the page 12 in terms of the way you calculated it. Let me ask you a question in addition to what has been asked. These are non-cancelable leases, right? So in a non-cancelable lease, if I cancel something, I might have to pay some penalty. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, where that would affect in your option Y in terms of it, because option Y is kind of a plug, not in a negative way plug, but it is like you're taking the receivable balance, the computed receivable balance, and the computed or the existing residual asset, and you're adding those two and putting it as a new asset number. Now, I got some money because I canceled it.
Mm-hmm.
My lessee canceled it. I got some money. How does that impact the calculation here? Would that be a receivable impairment will be lower, or will it be?
Yeah. So the receivable, because I think we said the way that we would test the in step one, if you think of it step one, when we do the testing under the impairment guidance, it would be your collateral plus any cash you receive on cancellation of the lease is what you're comparing the carrying amount to. So if you got any cash in, it would reduce.
But 32 is devoid. 32 is devoid of the 32 is devoid of the any cash. You're saying.
I think in the example, we've assumed that you didn't get any cash when you reclaimed.
So
the assets.
Should I assume that whenever I do this 32 calculation, I have to take all cash that is going to come?
Yes.
Yeah, I think we say it in the paper, but we made it.
Isn't that excluding one or the other? If I take the present value of the future cash flows, I cannot take the penalty into consideration. If I take penalty into consideration, I cannot take the future cash flows into consideration. I thought they're mutually exclusive.
Because if you think about it, if I can get a penalty from you, but I can also lease this thing for another 2 years, I'm going to get all of that cash. So you can add them both
this
together.
This 2 years lease, this 2 years cash flow is irrespective of the
penalty.
That lease, any lease I can do? I didn't get what is that, how do I calculate that 32? I'm looking at the box you
yeah,
put.
Yeah, sure.
One way of calculating the portion yeah. of the underlying fair value is the?
So it's the lessor saying, okay, I know the fair value of the entire asset is 80 at the point in time when the lease
That's
effectively
fine.
Collapses. And they're saying that 80 is effectively the PV of all the future cash flows. So what?
That's fair.
Okay, so what exactly? So now they're saying, what do I think the PV of the next 2 years' worth of cash flows is?
Why 2 years?
Because that was the remaining term on the lease. So that relates. That's the collateral that you've got on the piece of the lease that is the lease receivable. Because that's the way that we think that we said that we would do the impairment testing. We would effectively break the underlying asset up into its two pieces. Because that's the way that we do the receivable and residual. We're saying you've got two pieces. One's the lease receivable, and one is the net residual. And we said when we're doing the impairment testing, it doesn't make sense to compare the full value of the underlying asset to the lease receivable, because then you're comparing apples and oranges. If that makes sense. Sorry, you're comparing two different things.
Here is my confusion coming from. You took the 80 from this day onwards, the future cash flows you have discounted back from end of year one. But the 32 is based on the receivable balance, what has been agreed a year ago. That has,
It's based on your assessment today of what cash flows you think you could get.
Yeah.
During the remaining
yeah.
lease term.
Yeah. So that's
what
I said.
That was not clear here for me.
Sorry.
Then I can see some logic in here. You're comparing apples to apples.
Yeah.
You're taking off the portion of 80, how much of it belongs to the next 2 years.
Yes.
I think that should be much more clearly mentioned.
So what's the calculation behind the 32?
It's a 2 year lease that they have.
It's a PV of 2 years of lease payments. If you were to release the underlying asset today, what's the PV of 2 years of the cash flows that you're going to get?
So why is that less than the carrying amount of the receivable?
Because we're assuming you're no longer going to get the cash flows according to this lease contract. It's saying, this lease contract has, that's why you're testing it. You're saying there's some doubt about.
Yeah. I mean, things might have changed. Sorry.
Yeah. So
things might have changed in the interim. Yeah. I mean, there might have been a change in supply and demand for the underlying asset. When the lessor prices it, he might price it so that he gets more of the cash at the end rather than the beginning. If it breaks too early, your value of your asset reduces faster than you actually get your payment. So for a lot of reasons, it might be lower.
So if you like, the sort of collateral underlying your receivable is the remaining 2 years' right to use the asset. What's the value of 2 years of right to use this asset today?
Yes, exactly right.
Given that the lease has fallen over. If I was to re-lease for 2 years, what would the value be? There's some logic.
And I mean, Steve, I would imagine in practice that you could work that out two ways. You could do it like we would describe. They might be saying, what could I get if I leased this out for the next 2 years today? It might also be that you know the 80, and maybe as a lessor, you know what the asset, will be worth at the end of, two more years in terms of what's made up that 80, and you might be working out, the 32 as the difference between what mm-hmm. The whole asset is worth today and what you expect it to be worth, the whole asset to be worth.
So is it possible in option Y, the asset balance to be higher than $80 then? Because if I think the next 2 years I'm going to get $50 of leases, of revenue, then 50 plus 47 is more than.
If you wouldn't record a gain, because that's just when you do your impairment test, you look at the fair value of the collateral. That doesn't mean you remeasure it to fair value. So
I'm not booking gain. I'm not booking loss.
Correct.
I'm not booking a loss. So if I have receivable instead of 32 to be 40 or 50, then I will have a receivable balance higher than 80, because there is no loss.
Yeah. Exactly. Because economically you don't have a loss. Yeah.
Sorry. So,
yes, Stephen.
What are the other ways of calculating the 32? So you say one way.
Yes.
I don't know if I'm saying, I described another way in my mind that I think it might be done, that you've worked out the 80 today. You might also, as the lessor, know what you think that asset, what you could sell that asset for at the end of another 2 years.
Is this
years.
Free choice, or is there conceptually a right way?
I think we're just, I mean, it obviously, it might depend somewhat, Sue, for me, on how detailed or exact you want to be, or how detailed or exact you want to be within your impairment guidance, because this is just trying to say, look, when you impairment test the receivable, what you're comparing to that carrying amount of the receivable is the fair value of
I think, I'm not sure how prescriptive we want to be. I think that the idea underlying option Y is that when you work out what your expected losses are, to work out the impairment on the receivable, the asset that you need to be thinking about to measure your expected losses is your collateral, for want of a better word, which is the right to use for the remaining lease term. And then you'll need to think about the best way to measure that. I don't know that we want to tell people how to do that, but that's the concept.
And I think we'd want to be clear about that concept, but I don't know whether we'd want to mandate one particular way of
I mean, in my mind, I'd imagine
if market remains stable, like what you have leased on day one is the same as the end of year one, I would not think there is a lease impairment in that situation. You're assuming that the market has changed for bad or something like that. Although that's not reflected in the asset value,
I mean,
but
yeah.
If a market remains stable, I think there is a chance that there is no lease impairment at all. And I think that's
I think there is a chance, PK, but I think that, and Henry, correct me if I'm wrong, is I think if a lease does go back, you know, if you think about the receivable and residual approach is going to be applied mostly when it's equipment and vehicle leases. And when a lessor prices a contract that he assumes is going to last 3 years or say 5 years, and that lease goes bad somewhere shorter than that, given that the value, kind of the fair value of equipment and vehicles, asset often depreciates faster in the early years. I think that if a lease goes bad somewhere before the end of the lease term, chances are there could be an impairment there.
Yeah. If you
just because you've kind of priced the contract over a 3 or 5 year period, assuming you're going to get kind of, you know, even cash flow stream, but the actual value could decline.
Well, as you mentioned, PK, equipment lessors, we asked about these scenarios. They said very often there would be penalty clauses in the contract, and then once you add that, you would not actually end up having impairment. Yeah, there are some contracts without any in which this could happen, but often you would have a clause that would provide penalties as a protective lessor.
There's no penalty. I would say it's a cancelable lease. Mm. It's a cancelable lease. Okay. I understand what you mean.
Any other comments, requests for enlightenment?
Sorry. Let's suppose the fair value of the asset at the end of year one was 93.
Mm-hmm.
To my mind, the lessor has not lost anything as a result of this transaction, because the 93 is the same as the carrying value for the receivable and the residual. So I've just sold the asset and I've recovered both of those two. My understanding of approach Y is we still book a loss.
Well, how much would you assign of that 93 to the receivable, I think would be the question.
Okay,
so because you're saying it's higher then, so.
Yeah, so I'm assuming similar methodology, you'd assign an amount that
would still
create an impairment on the
receivable. I think you might still end up with a loss then, Steve, because I think in the you're right, the carrying value is 93, but there's some deferred profit sitting in there, so on a fair value basis, you have still got a loss. So if you said the asset was still worth 100, at the end of year one, then you probably wouldn't get a loss. But
you'll get
if you have 93, loss. Then it has really gone down, which means when you allocate some of that to the receivable, there is going to be a small loss. But if what you're saying is if it's 100, then I don't think you...
You'll get $7 loss in the situation of 93.
I mean, your point might be that you think that overall, if there isn't, you know, if the overall value of the underlying isn't lower than the combined amount of the receivable and residual, you think it would be wrong to take an impairment loss. And I think I understand what you're saying. It's just that I think, as Gary said before, the reason why under approach one you still might take it is because how we're viewing the receivable and residual approach is that on day one when you've entered into the lease, you have actually almost, you know, you've created two assets in a sense. You've transformed the asset into two separate assets. So in your case, if you think, oh, the overall value has, you know, isn't lower than the combined carrying amount, when Approach Y would still say there might be impairment is because effectively if there is a buffer in the residual, because you might say overall I don't think I should take impairment, but if we would take impairment under Y, it's because under your thinking why you shouldn't, it's because there's a buffer in the residual. And what Y is kind of saying is that receivable and residual approach, the model works to say I should only be taking profit on the piece of the underlying I've sold, and somehow it would seem inappropriate to take some of that profit in the residual just because actually the contract's gone bad, you know, when I didn't allow that profit to be taken.
I think option Y absolutely sort of respects the logic behind the residual and receivable approach, and it respects the logic behind the impairment model for financial assets and for physical assets, if you like, 36 versus IFRS 9. I think the question for me is more the complexity around this. I mean, this is the residual and receivable approach is already, you know, it's sort of a construct we've come up with. We think it provides useful information. But you can see that if you follow it to its sort of logical extreme, it starts to become pretty complicated, some of these calculations we're talking about people doing. And for me, I think that's one of the things we need to be thinking about.
What's the solution?
Cost-benefit of that.
Well, I mean, I think that's why Steve's point at the start is a very fair point, to sort of say, you know, option X has the merit of the simplicity about it, and you're right about then it avoids the arbitrariness of how you've allocated the value of the underlying asset between the two pieces.
Yeah.
Okay. So that you know, I mean, I absolutely agree with what Sue said, is that Y preserves the integrity of the philosophy of the model, and the question is whether, you know, the complexity gets in the way then you want to do something different and depart from
but
the
underlying. But there's one more benefit too, Henry, to Approach Y. Obviously, when I saw the words fair value, my eyes light up. but here, there is a moral hazard in that fair value here, because you're dealing with a cost model, okay, would allow you essentially create gain on sale accounting or gain on repossession accounting. It creates a perverse incentive. So hence, I said, it's really only fair value in disguise.
So the
reality is that I think fair value here creates a problem. It doesn't solve a problem.
But Steve, aren't what you were suggesting is something more like a lower of cost or market model, where if the market value exceeded the carrying amount of the receivable and residual, you just put the receivable and residual together, and if it was less, you'd take a loss. You weren't suggesting that you'd have a gain on.
But exactly, you're still recognizing profit in that scenario, which I think is not healthy.
Sue's point, it is simpler.
Well, it's simple, but my bigger concern was the perverse incentive that could be created with that accounting.
No, because you have no gain.
Yeah, exactly.
If you have no gain, what's the incentive?
And just to clarify,
you'd be booking a gain, though. Under Approach X, potentially.
Okay,
that's not what Steve was suggesting.
No, that's not his concern. But that was my concern.
Can I just to clarify? Would you also be suggesting that you don't that you should not have the impairment test just before you take back the asset? Is that what you're?
I think there is value in that.
What would Steve? What would you do though if the impairment? I mean, I think you pointed out there's often a times difference between when you think there's an impairment in the numbers and when you actually choose to do something about it. Would you not impair the asset even earlier in the process when you think you might do something about it? So you have a concern because your tenant has missed a payment and you started to talk to them about it. That may trigger a need for an impairment test, but it's not anywhere close to the decision to take back the asset.
I think the word triggers is worrying me a bit because this is an expected loss model, yes.
So something happens to give rise to an increased expectation in the loss. You haven't yet decided that you're going to do anything about it, but that something has happened to give rise to this.
The loss is on the total asset that you will repossess. It's not on the receivable. So you have to test your expectation of a loss when you comment on the new asset that you repossess, not a new battery. You repossess the asset. So while you don't have to wait for that confirmation to happen, you may expect it to happen and do your impairment test in advance.
In assessing the expected loss on the receivable component of this of these two assets, you would be continuously taking account of the fair value of your residual asset, the underlying residual asset. And in other words, recognizing through the whole impairment process the fact that that you may have a profit that you haven't recognized yet in the underlying asset.
But the problem that you are moving from a, we are moving this model from an expected loss on a receivable to an expected loss on an asset, repossessed asset. And the transition from one to the other is probably problematic a little bit, maybe, yes.
Because I think what's happening, Philippe, to your point, I think that you're saying is this, that I think the point Dahl's making is saying is before you actually repossess the asset, from an accounting perspective, you've got two separate assets. You've got a financial asset and a non-financial asset. So until the point you repossess, you're almost by definition, you, if there is any impairment, you have to impairment test those separately.
You're an impairment either because you have a credit loss on your receivable, that's a basic IFRS 9 impairment model, or there is another loss because of your expectation of a cancelled lease. Okay? That's a different type of expected loss. If you think of an expectation of a cancellation, what will happen is that you will repossess the asset, you will no longer have a receivable. So you assume that the receivable will be added back to your asset base, and then you test it for impairment against the market value, the fair value of the asset. You don't have to wait for that cancellation to take place to do this kind of calculation.
Well, I think it's a bit like a mortgage or something, isn't it, in the sense that you're looking at your expected losses based on the credit quality of your lessee, assuming that they're going to still be the lessee and looking at their credit risk. And then as a secondary factor, you're considering what your recourse would be or what your rights would be if they didn't pay under the lease. Because if they failed to pay under the lease, then you would be able, presumably in most leases, to take possession of the asset and then to try and release it. So you're thinking about the underlying right to use in that sort of secondary scenario after you've thought about the risk of the credit of the lessee as it's your primary sort of obligation.
They go.
Daniel, just to say, I try to repeat, you know, Judge, whether, you know, you confirm his the views. He said, you know, when you, before we possess, when you assess impairment, you will assess the receivable first, then integrate the fair value of the underlying.
The portion of the underlying related to the receivable.
Right to use.
Yeah, yeah. So just not the whole, I don't know if that's what you're saying, Daryl, not the whole underlying, just the portion of the underlying related to the receivable. Yeah. Yes.
But I just want to now take it, I mean, a little bit further. If I have leased somebody an asset that was on my balance sheet for a whole period of time, and subsequent to the lease, or even prior to the lease, the value of that asset has increased significantly. At a point in time, I now recognize that I am not going to receive the cash flows I expected under the terms of the lease. What I think this would, where we get to now is that I would assess whether or not I have an impairment based on both the value of the asset and the fact that the asset has increased would compensate me for the cash flows I don't expect to get.
Correct.
And that means, in essence, what I'm doing is I'm revaluing the asset.
Well, but you don't record that, though. You don't record that increase.
You don't record it other than to the extent that you don't take an impairment you otherwise would have.
Okay, you limit.
So you're compensating, you've got a natural impairment you should be taking, but you're compensating for that hole you've created by filling it with the increase in the value of the asset.
Sure. Okay.
Now, I see.
Also, the penalty portion is not portion of the asset. I don't get that thing. When you're talking receivable, where is the penalty coming into the picture? Because if you're talking about that portion of the underlying asset that is for the receivable, penalty doesn't enter into that equation.
It doesn't the impairment testing one.
But this impairment testing is different from the credit impairment we normally do. This impairment, what you're saying is that I have this lease for next 2 years. What will I get for that lease as against what I have on the books?
correct. That's
right? The collateral. I have on the books for $53 in this example, and if I lease it for next 2 years, I'm only going to get $32.
Correct.
Right? Therefore, there's an impairment of 21. In that, when I lease it out for next 2 years, I'm assuming $32 right now.
Yep.
But where is the penalty in that equation?
And I think, Sue, tell me if I'm wrong, but I mean, when you do your calculation to try and work out what loss you've got for that 2 years, you say, our impairment testing says, take whatever cash you think you're going to still get from your debtor, plus the collateral, and those two together you compare to the carrying value, because that's economically telling you whether or not you've got a loss. Otherwise, you're missing some of
it. I get that, but that has nothing to do with the portion of the asset. You're inflating the portion of the asset that relates to the underlying asset.
You're valuing the cash flows and the collateral and comparing it with the carrying amount of the receivable.
You're looking at what your loss given default would be. And if you had a default under the lease, what would my recourse be? My recourse would be to claim the termination penalty and rights you've got. And then you'd turn around and say, what else can I do with the asset? I've got the right to release it now for the period when this lessee should have been using it and then not any longer. And I guess as a secondary consideration, you'd also think, should I sell the whole asset?
So you're saying there could be a gain then instead of an impairment?
Because you do an impairment test. So you do the test, but that doesn't mean you record it at that number.
You might have no expected loss, but you're not going to say, I actually expect a super profit from the failure of my lessee.
Why? Because I can lease it for a better price.
But it's an impairment model. It's looking at, am I going to recover the expected cash flow?
That would be reflected
cash
in the next transaction.
Yes, an opportunity gain.
I think you have to bear in mind also that in these situations that people are going to be booking losses and not gains. Because that's what, you know, in these distressed situations, you know, that
I doubt very much people
are not fully collateralized and the asset is coming back earlier than expected.
That was the point made under option X. At the end of the two paragraphs on option X, the point was made that generally, if you went to fair value, it would be a loss.
Yeah, I mean, our understanding, as I say, in the context of equipment and vehicle leasing, our understanding from speaking to, I mean, by the way, it wasn't, but at least in speaking to a few lessors in that business, is that if a lease goes bad, generally speaking, that usually means a loss.
I still want to check, you know, because, you know, Daryl's, you know, explanation confused me. Our up-to-date decision is if you apply receivable residual method, impairment, our decision is you will, you know, assess impairment of receivable based on financial instrument standards and assess impairment of the residuals based on 36. And now Daryl said that when you assess the impairment of receivables, you should also take into consideration of the fair value of the underlying.
Can I perhaps put it a slightly different way? I think the way I read Y is that we look at the collateral as being the remaining term of the lease. The way I understood Steve was suggesting is we look at the collateral as being the whole asset, because you can look to the value of the asset. Is that a fair... So it was just presenting the two different options. That's what I was just trying to get.
You're looking at the two in aggregate.
So there are two different ways of looking at
it. No, I want to make it clear. You know, what's the decision we made a long time ago? And so one interpretation is you assess impairment separately, purely based on different standards. And Daryl just said is you have to take into consideration or the fair value of the underlying.
But it means you Daryl, just the portion related to the lease receivable.
I think we're good. Can I just clarify with Steve Wigger? I think under what option Y is suggesting is not that. Option Y is saying when you're looking at the receivable and doing impairment testing, you're only picking up the portion, you know, the portion of the overall value of the asset that relates to the receivable, relates to the right of use. I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, Steve, I think what Steve is saying is what you're now suggesting is, Steve, is that right, is that under this model, you would change the board's decision, you wouldn't do separate impairment testing of these two amounts. You would always effectively impairment test the two amounts together by comparing the full value of the underlying with to the carrying amount of both the receivable and the residual.
Yes, I guess I would. And I was trying to think of parallels in other areas of accounting, and we're going to come on this week to talk about revenue recognition and onerous contract tests. and we're moving potentially from looking at it at the performance obligation level to the contract level. Mm. And that kind of is consistent, different situation, but it's kind of parallel for what we're thinking about here.
Agreed, yep.
And then there's the equipment leases versus property leases, our two models. If it's a property, it's one asset. If it's an equipment lease, it's two assets. But it's not really two assets. It's kind of one asset with two different characteristics. And this is the problem we've had all along, isn't it? Whether you really sold something and ended up with a different asset, or whether it was really part of the same asset. And it's a kind of a mixture of the two.
But can I ask you a question, Steve? What model here provides the investor a better signal about the quality of the business that you're in? One in which you recognize losses related to essentially the lending of an asset in the receivable, or one that is going to allow, when these events occur, you to package the two back up together and kind of mask essentially the profitability related to the residual and the receivable. And I actually think your analysis related to revenue recognition is spot on, and hence the reason why I think we should keep that onerous contract test at the performance obligation level. Mm. But being that as it may, I think this highlights the value that is being brought to the table for the investor of your ability to assess the underlying credit and to lease, you know, at a profit. And if you're not doing that business or conducting that business profitably, this would highlight it better. Taking into consideration the value of the lease residual, in my mind, masks a little of that. You might be in a situation where you have appreciating assets. I'd want to know that. I want to know the segmentation of the sources of earnings. This provides you with better information.
But in that case, because of the table reconciling the lease receivable from opening to your end, you would have a reclassification of the lease receivable that will show up in this table. So there will be a signal that a significant lease receivable has been reclassified. And you may have whatever information you need. It doesn't necessarily trigger a loss if the underlying value has maintained or kept up. So just having an explanation of the reason for this reclassification might tell you what you need to know.
I don't think so.
Why? What do you want to know? There is no loss.
There may not be a loss in the aggregate, but it will tell me whether or not I had a loss on that lending transaction that created the receivable. And that's important because that's the business I'm in.
I think you just need to be aware that that any option other than the option, well, why, in a sense, I suppose, going to more on option X or fair value or doing more impairment testing combined, and I think there's all kinds of good reasons potentially to do that, but you just need to be aware that that would mean that in respect of impairment testing, we are kind of changing the model somewhat, because that model, the receivable and residual approach in terms of our other decisions, really does treat it like a partial derecognition. It's a partial sale model. You know, we're saying when a lessor enters into a lease, they have sold a piece of the underlying asset. So if we want to do something different in impairment testing, which we might want to for very good reasons, then we would just need to think about that, because in every other respect, we're piecing up that one.
But you'd have to scope it back out of the IFRS 9 somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean,
we need to work out then what would potentially be the triggers then for impairment if we don't have, we need to write our own impairment guidance.
Or at least have something that talks about how to measure expected losses differently in this type of scenario.
I'm not sure, because I think, and I just to perhaps for the record, I do like why. I think I confused it by trying to talk about what I thought the two different spaces were. But I think in essence what we're simply saying is that, as what I described a little bit earlier, is that what you're saying is in doing the impairment test, you can take into account as the full value of the collateral you've got against that, the full asset. So the possibility of being able to sell the whole asset and whatever profit you made on the whole asset, you could treat that as collateral. Now, I disagree with that, because I think what we've effectively said is we've got two pieces of asset here, and the one part of the asset has got nothing to do with the client. That's my asset, and I'm keeping it. And so the only asset that I think is relevant for collateral is the other piece. But if we're looking at, I think the way Steve's proposed from, to my mind, thinking about it, is you're just simply saying the whole asset and the ability to sell that asset at the moment the contract terminates is the collateral that you're taking in account. And then the carrying value of that asset is whatever the carrying value of the residual is and whatever the carrying value of the receivable is.
And I guess the other thing we'd have to think about if you did want to go down that route is we'd be ending up thinking about one asset in an impairment calculation partly for a financial asset and partly for a 36 asset. And then we've and one model's an expected loss model, the other's an incurred loss type model. And I don't know what comes out of combining those things together. I haven't thought it through.
I mean, one of the other things is it's just, yeah.
So,
okay.
So the confusion has been resolved? We have to come to an end to this debate.
I've been educated.
Martin, and then we'll talk about
that. Only I think because I think in this situation what you described, I think economically there is not a loss, and the loss comes because we separate this lease contract into a receivable and we have the underlying asset. And then if it comes to the termination of the lease, then we look at both assets differently. This is my understanding, and therefore we allocate a portion of the value of the underlying asset to the receivable. And I have to say, I find this a little bit strange because if you compare that providing a loan to a customer and you have that loan is with assets as securities, collateral, and if you then come to an impairment test, you would then compare that, okay, what was the original value of that collateral? And that is only allowed then, okay, for the impairment test, but if the collateral has increased in fair value, you don't take this part. And therefore, I think I would really have things, okay, that we should do it together and not really if do an impairment test, do receivables, and then look at the assets. So I think economically, and that was your argument, economically there is no loss, because in this situation, the fair value of the underlying asset has increased, and you should not book a gain from that, but at least we should take this part of the fair value increase to not book an impairment. Because this impairment you book only because you have separated in the financial asset and the underlying.
The problem is that there is a loss on the piece that was subject to the lease.
I know.
There's not a loss on the. There's a profit on the piece that you kept.
Correct. Yeah.
And to my mind, the close analogy in revenue is that I sell you a piece of inventory for $1,000 that cost me an $800, made a profit of $200, but I realize immediately you can't pay, so I take it back. I know that the inventory is worth $1,000 because I'm selling it to other people. Can I recognize that $200 as a profit? Because the underlying asset is worth $1,000. It's that concept I think that's worrying me.
And we have a piece of this asset, the residual, that you've never derecognized or anything, that's just sitting there at cost.
Exactly.
And then you suddenly start thinking about the fair value of the whole asset.
We haven't sold that thing at all, and yet we suddenly...
It's actually different to your analogy in a sense, in that we've never sold that piece.
Yeah, I mean, for me, like when we ended up looking at the different options, I think Y makes the most sense because it aligns with previous decisions that have been made. I think, as Sue said, if we start trying to tweak the way we're going to do this, we need to start asking questions around all those other decisions, because for me, the big issue with doing it the way that maybe Steve is thinking about it is that it means that you're comparing the fair value of the deferred of the piece that you never actually sold, which means that you end up recording some of that deferred profit because it masks some of the impairments on the receivable piece. And go back to the decision, the boards didn't want to record any of that profit. So you get to record a piece of it by recording less of an impairment. It just seems inconsistent with that decision of not recording any of the profit on the asset that we still keep, the piece of the asset that we keep. So
we should stop talking while Steve's still happy.
Okay, yes, we have to round this up.